Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. Joining us today, we've got Raphael Michael. Hello, Raphael. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
No, I'm really excited to talk to you. I know you first from DjangoCon Europe back in Heidelberg, really. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about who yourself, about yourself, and how did you find Django?
How did I find Django? I think that's an interesting story. I haven't thought about it in a long time. I think I was a student at high school, and I was doing a lot of web development on the side as a hobby and later as a small mini job. And there was this German website that sold t-shirts with IT motives, and they had on their Twitter account, back when Twitter was a thing, right? They had, I think it was a raffle for a free t-shirt. I don't remember what you needed to do for it, but I entered into the raffle, and I don't even remember if I won, but somehow the CEO of that company looked at my website and was impressed by this 15-year-old doing web development and offered me an internship that I didn't take because it was in a city at the other end, on the other end of the country. But I think that internship description was the first time I saw that Django is a thing, and it kind of made me look into what that is.
Right, okay. So that's quite good, because that's almost like the universe aligning the planets there for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought you were going to say you'd won the t-shirt.
I think I've got a t-shirt after all that. I'm not sure if I've okay. Officially won it or but it made me look into Python first and then later into Django, and then I think starting 2013 every new project I touched became a Django project instead of a PHP project.
Okay, so you did the PHP to Django maneuver.
Yeah.
We should get a support group for such.
Well, I think the docs are still heavily, there's an assumption built in that you're coming from PHP, because back when, you know, Adrian and everyone else wrote them, that's what the move was.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. PHP also has changed a lot, or how people use it has changed a lot since then. I think they used to be quite similar back then, and maybe they are more similar today than they were in the time between. But I'm not using it anymore these days. I had one remaining PHP project until like 2 or 3 years ago, but now it's all gone.
Okay. So, I mean, there's two things that linger, right? One is in the request object, you've got the capital get and the capital post, from which is explicitly PHP. And then the other is the template tag for formatting a date. It uses, you know, miraculous, it uses the PHP, and so you always have to look it up because it's not like anything else you use at any other time. But
well, I'm going later this week to see a friend, a meetup here in Boston, and a friend who uses Laravel, and he's just the biggest evangelist ever for Laravel and has been for a while. And so through him, I've been hearing for years just about all the changes. I mean, Laravel really seems to have given PHP a second wave, if you will. I know PHP, the language itself, adopted some Pythonic features, and then Laravel is, especially for consultancies, has a lot of features, and in some ways is a little bit easier than Django in terms of, you know, cookie cutter kind of stuff. It has built-in hosting solution. It's got a starter project, and it has one person in charge, essentially, which means they can go a lot faster than we can in Django world.
And at least for some target groups, the deployment story for PHP is still simpler, but still put your files there and it works.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, that's the original appeal of PHP. And then I think the fact that there's a hosted official solution means if you're an agency, for sure, just... And yeah, Taylor, yeah. I think the creator has talked openly. I think it's just a couple big boxes he's got running millions of dollars a year of hosted stuff. So just think if Django had something like that. Anyways,
So I'd ask you though, Rafa, you've been using Django for well over a decade now, and this question comes up quite often. Should we copy things from Laravel? Should we copy things from Rails? Should we do that? Are there things that stand out for you that we should be doing as an ecosystem that we're not?
I'm not so sure. Probably something I would need to think about more, but also I'm not monitoring the other ecosystems that well. For me, Django very much fits how my brain works. It's similar to, like, in the JavaScript world, Vue fits my brain model a lot better than React, for example. I don't know why. I've worked with both, and one feels natural to me and the other one doesn't. And there is, after a decade, I've settled in the Django ecosystem so much that, like, it doesn't bother me anymore if anything is missing, because I have my strategy how to deal with it for a while.
Yeah, right. So you got your solution, and that's what you do.
Obviously, there's things that aren't perfect. Talking about deployment, talking about assets pipelines, talking about lots of other stuff. I think those are no secrets. But I'm also not aware of other ecosystems where I would say, okay, I've seen this is perfect. We should copy that.
Right. Okay. Good.
Let me ask you about authentication, because Carlton and I have been making a bit of a stink around this recently. How do you like to handle authentication? And we'll get to, you have various projects at, you know, scale and not. That seems to me to be one of the ones where there isn't one solution for the community. So how do you like to handle user auth?
So the thing is that I don't work in the agency world with setting up three new projects per year and needing lots of reproducibility or lots of pluggability. I work with long-standing projects that are quite complex and develop over long time frames. And so I find that all the packages that try to do authentication for you are too opinionated or too specific and don't fit into my products as much as I wanted to. So for the large projects I'm working on, I'm going with plain Django and building everything on top myself or ourselves. And yes, I have implemented OpenID Connect from scratch before. It's not something I would recommend, but
the tear of blood that drips down as you say that.
We have a few other projects where this bothers me. Like, we have a few internal tools built with Django. For example, we run also our company invoicing on Django, basically on the Django admin. And we have a tool that manages the something like a package repository for the software that we deliver to our clients. It's also a small Django project. And for those smaller projects, what I'm missing is, for example, good two-factor support. So I'm using one of these packages, one of the many packages for two-factor that I can just put into my installed apps and it works. But it doesn't work very well and it's not very nicely integrated. Then the templates look different and it's not really the best thing or the best solution to the problem. I think what I would rather want to see there would be better low-level batteries for that included in Django, like a base view to do TOTP and web auth and authentication, and then have me bring my own templates, like I bring my own login template, because it should look like the rest of my application.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I mean, Andrew Godwin had this line about the batteries included thing, that Django should provide the hard batteries and let everyone else produce the easy ones. And those kind of low-level views, they're the hard things that you have to get right. But then the templates, you know, there's no reason for us to have an opinion on that. No, that's super. We want to go on to your work and but I wanted to talk about you organizing DjangoCon Europe and how you did that and how you found that and, you know, how you see DjangoCon Europe going forward.
Oh, dangerous.
Yeah. No, okay. It has to be slightly spicy, otherwise no one listens.
In 2017, at the DjangoCon Europe conference in Florence, my friend Tobias and I, we listened to the complaints that no one has signed up to do DjangoCon Europe the following year.
The eternal complaints, yeah.
The internal complaint. And we put our hands up and submitted a proposal to do it in my hometown of Heidelberg, here in Germany, which was
wonderful, by the way. Such a lovely town, such a lovely venue. If you ever got the energy to organize it there again, I'd definitely come back. I love the Philosopher's Walk, the other side of the river.
Good cities to host DjangoCon Europe in. And I think Europe has so many cities that fit the criteria that we don't need to repeat them yet. Maybe
not yet.
In a few decades, but I don't think we need to repeat cities for DjangoCon Europe yet. But I think the perfect location for DjangoCon Europe is it needs to be big enough to host 400, 500 people, have the hotel rooms and infrastructure and travel connections, everything, but it needs to be small enough to be walkable, to meet people again in the city after the conference. I like the feeling of going through a small town, going out to dinner with some folks to a restaurant, then leaving the restaurant again, going to another place, and again meeting Django people. That doesn't work like if we were doing it in London or something like that. It's just at some point the city is too big, it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the way a lot, but I think DjangoCon Europe works best.
How did you find the experience? How was the experience of organizing the conference?
It was exhausting and also a lot of fun. It was hard because in the beginning you start trying to build a group of volunteers that work on it, but few people can properly estimate the amount of work this takes beforehand. You get a lot of people signing up for it and then not following through. And in the end, one of the sad parts of DjangoCon Europe is that in the end, in most years, it came down to 1, 2, 3 people carrying the bulk of the load. And it's not a full-time job, but it comes close in some of the months ahead of it. And that's a lot to take on.
Okay. And so 6 years later, like, you've obviously thought about this, and like, do you have ideas for the sustainability of Django? We've been lucky that we carried on, and the Porto team were great, who kept it going over the pandemic period. But it seems like every year there's this same, you said in 2017, the problem was no one had stood for. Well, it sort of feels like that's a familiar story. How do we make it sustainable?
Interestingly, we've had more proposals to host it recently. Don't think it's something I can go into too much detail about at the moment. But it continues to be a problem, and it's a very hard problem to solve, because we want the conference to travel around Europe, and we want new people to come in and do something creative with that, change it a little bit and make it better, hopefully. And for example, a large part of doing it for the first time that makes it hard is setting up the legal structure to host it. You need an association or a company. Somebody needs to be responsible. And I don't know, if it ever goes wrong, someone needs to go bankrupt probably. So usually that shouldn't be a person. It has been a person before, but it should be a company or an association that you can have dedicated for this. And depending on the country, this is quite a lot of effort to set up, especially if you haven't done it before. It takes time, it takes effort. And it's one of the things that makes it hard to carry a lot of these. Like, it's not an interesting part of hosting the conference, like assembling the program, doing social events, that is the fun part. But setting up a company or an association is not the fun part of organizing a conference. But it's one that we need to do every year, because it's so complicated for, say, a Spanish company to host an event in Sweden. Legally, that we basically need a new one every year because we want to switch countries. So that's a problem that in the US with DjangoCon US and DEFNA, it's the same legal association over and over again. And it would be amazing to make this easier and have more continue with the people, with the money, with the processes. But even though the European Union, even though it would be even harder without the European Union, it's still pretty hard.
So that was my kind of question. Is there not, does the EU not somehow, does the single market somehow not somehow make that cross-border thing work?
It's not impossible. EuroPython is doing it, for example. EuroPython is a Swedish society, and they are currently putting on their event in the Czech Republic. However, that also means because they're physically holding the event in the Czech Republic, the Czech Republic has a right to the tax income. And right. So the Swedish EuroPython Society needs to register as a tax citizen in the Czech Republic. Not so different from setting up a new company. And EuroPython has, I think, about 10 times the budget of DjangoCon Europe. At 10 times the budget, it becomes more feasible to just hire lawyers and accountants to deal with it. And it's still a lot of work for them. It's not just hiring anyone. They still struggle with it a lot. So, doing that at a much smaller budget makes the event more expensive for everyone to attend.
Right. Okay. Because EuroPython's like 1,000 people, right?
I actually have no idea how many attendees they have. At least 1,000, I believe. But they have, in any case, they have a larger budget for it.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I recall all these conversations when I was on the board of the Django Software Foundation, because the organizers want and need help, and there's always the idea of, well, maybe we can be under the banner of EuroPython, which maybe, but they're also not this huge organization either, and it's too bad we haven't figured out a solution, because it's so much work just to do the fun stuff, let alone all the money side. And I recall, a lot of conversations around the US DSF trying to set up a European bank account and all these kind of things that maybe we just need to ask EuroPython more forcefully or something.
Yeah, I'm hopeful we will, it's not a new conversation, and I'm hopeful we will find a solution someday, and I'm thinking about it regularly, but I have not found one yet.
But there are positive steps as well, right? There's the DjangoCon Europe working group, and that you're involved with, right? To give people more support.
Yes, there's a working group in the DSF that tries to support new organizers and to collect information from past organizers. Something that has been going on before as well, but now in a little bit more formalized way. But if you say you want to do it for 2027. For example, you can ask the support group any questions you might have about it, or if you can have access to past budgets or whatever that we can share with you to give you a little bit of a head start. And we also try to, the support group is quite new, and the current organizers are quite experienced, so it's not happening that much. But the idea is also to check in with the current organizers now and then, and see if they actively check in and see if they need any help or any further information.
And just one more thought before we move on. If people have got like a half inkling, they think, well, maybe I could do a DjangoCon Europe 1 year, they should reach out, right?
They should reach out. They should reach out either via email to the support group, or add a DjangoCon or another event to someone who has done it before in person. That's sometimes the more effective way to get the information that you won't find in writing, and to get a little bit of feeling about how it works and how to approach it.
And I just saw, so we're recording on November 12th, and this episode will come out a little bit later, but just yesterday, all the details around next year's DjangoCon in Dublin came out, including a date, which is April 23rd to 27th. So I'm very excited about having a date, and Dublin's a great place.
Another thing that has been now improved, finally, that we've also been talking about for 10 years, is the planning period has gotten longer. So when we signed up in 2017 for 2018, we had, I think, 10 months left to plan it, which is not a lot of time to find a venue and just get everything set up. Now the Django Software Foundation has already requested proposals for 2026. This year, the deadline has already closed. And so there is the attempt to make the planning period longer, and that will also make it less stressful, hopefully.
Yeah, it feels like you've an awful lot to organize in a very, if you try and do it in a short period of time.
Well, we also have a new board, or we have four new board members that will be announced soon. And I'm very, the quality of the candidates was amazing, and there's a lot of energy out there. So I know that having new and energetic and international board members will help with all this. So that's definitely something to look forward to. I also want to say, like, we talk about how much work it is to organize these things, but you get so much back, like, just like anything, when you put yourself out there, right? I'm sure just for you organizing the event, you meet and, you know, work in a volunteer capacity with people you wouldn't know before. And, you know, I feel like you get a lot back from any,
yeah,
you know, like we do with this podcast. You know, we don't monetize it at all, but I feel like, just for myself, my happiness with Django, and get, you know, reaching out to people like yourself. So same thing with organizing a conference. The best way to meet people and get involved is to get involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to ask, you're very entrepreneurial. You have this company, Rami.io, and a couple products. What is the full suite of, I almost don't know where to start. I mean, because you have a number of employees and products.
I was going to say, Raphael, tell us about your work, because I know you do some stuff and it's all in this area over here, but there's a lot going on.
So maybe let's start. How many employees do you work with now? Because I heard you mentioned 13, I think, 2 years ago.
Yeah, we're a team of 21 right now.
You're in charge of that? You're the main ringleader?
Yes. Yeah.
That's quite a lot to do.
It used to be a lot of stuff that I was doing, but we were trying really hard to focus currently. And basically our main product is Pretix, which is a ticketing solution for any place where you pay to get in, which involves the entire event industry, as well as parts of the leisure industry, such as museums or swimming pools or wherever you pay to get in, this is our target group. And we try to provide an end-to-end solution with online sales and ticket access control and cash registers and so on. And the smaller product that we have that started in the pandemic is Venueless, which is a live event platform, kind of combines live streaming and video calling into one tool and a few other things. To hold conferences online, which is something that we come up with to help our clients, mostly 2020 to 2022, do their conferences at all. And now we still have a number of clients that use it to do hybrid or still fully remote conferences.
Yeah, can I ask about the hybrid nature? Is that holding up? So I mean, during the pandemic, obviously it was all online only, and then the first year back there was very much a two stream type thing, online tickets as well. But how's the hybrid thing holding up? Because it seemed like it was a growth thing, it was a new feature that we should keep.
Yeah, but that's not what happened. So the larger part of the event industry has fully abandoned and went back to in person only.
Okay.
Hybrid events are very hard to run properly, especially if you want to do some proper community management and involvement of the online audience as well. Like, streaming to YouTube is simple, but properly making it a connecting experience out of a hybrid event is really, really hard and takes a lot more work and cost than doing either one. We have a client who runs a lot of conferences every year, and they decided, okay, we're going to do half of it virtual and half of it in person, but we're not going to touch hybrid. It's too hard. It's too complex. Okay. They also want to be able to select different kinds of content for the different types of audiences and so on. So we still have we have hybrid conferences on the platform, but compared to the total amounts of conferences that we work with or that we know, it's a very small number.
Okay, interesting.
So there's so many questions. Maybe one of the, you know, the high level question is, this is open source software, and yet you support a team of 21. How do you, and I know you've given a talk that we're going to link to at Fossback on building a business around open source applications. But what is the short version of how you manage that? Right, because that seems like the dream for a lot of people.
The short version is that most of our customers run events, and either they have no idea what open source means and how to run a Django software on a server, or they know what it is, but they don't have the time to because they're running.
I don't want to go near it.
So our main revenue stream is providing the solution as software as a service. We also do all of the other kinds that you can monetize open source software. We have proprietary add-ons that you can purchase from us that are not open source. We sell support services, but really 90% of our revenue comes from software as a service because people just don't want to deal with running the software themselves. And it makes sense. It's kind of mission critical for a lot of them. Like if you're an event business, selling tickets is your revenue stream. And on the day of the event, scanning the tickets and printing badges is a very important part of your user journey. And you don't want to deal with a server outage yourself in that situation.
Yeah, right.
So when I look at the Git history for the project, I see January 2015, and I think is the first public commits.
September 2014 already. Otherwise, we would have hosted our birthday party at the wrong date.
maybe I'm doing my search incorrectly, but I guess the yeah, question is all around
10 years now.
Yeah. And so what's the story of that, right? I mean, because it was you, right? Like you had this inkling and you put a lot of work into this product,
yeah,
you know, not knowing that you'd be where you are now.
DjangoCon Europe is not the first community conference that I co-organized. I started to get involved with a local conference. It's called MRMCD. It's from the local, let's say, privacy and open source community. And somehow I raised my hand at the question of who's going to deal with ticketing and money. And so I fell into that hole. And there is not a lot of open source software to deal with such things out there. And we tried one or two, and it was all bad. And so I decided I'm going to start my own. And I consciously, because in that community, there's a lot of homegrown software that someone maintains for 2 or 3 years, and then it's no longer around and nobody cares about the software anymore. So it was a conscious decision to try to do it in a way that allows me to make it sustainable. It was never the plan to build a company with 20 employees out of, but it was the plan to somehow monetize it to keep it alive.
I'm going to ask, because you start something new and you look at what's out there and you think none of these are any good, but they've all got more features than like you realize that you have to build when you start, right? Like you think, I could get this built up quite quickly, but then you realize, oh, it sends emails and it's got this and it's got that. And how long did it take before it started to mature? So you start to think, oh, actually, it's you know, obviously there's always more you can build and always things you can make better.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not done yet, right?
But how long till it's...
So first commit, I think, end of 2014, I was running my own conference, or the one that triggered the creation, on it June 2015, so
okay,
8 months later. And I think the first event that was not run by me with a lot of patching on the job was a year later, early 2016, when we launched
for 18 months.
I launched the software as a service version, I think, January 2017, so a full 2.5 years after the idea.
For ticketing in the United States anyways, we have this company Ticketmaster, which is, I'll go on record as saying, pretty much evil. And not only are they expensive, but they're also, they don't work all the time. So I know that, you know, when you have challenges of these big spikes of traffic, right? Where
yes.
nothing. How did you originally tackle that? And I'm sure that's a huge issue now, right? When you have very irregular streams of usage.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the hard engineering challenges in ticketing, and it's not one we solved either. I believe it would be quite feasible to build the ticketing system that scales almost infinitely if you would constrain yourself to a very small feature set and a very specific use case. But that's not what we do. We have a very extensive product with a lot of complexity. Think about, and a lot of the problem is that you don't only have these large load spikes, but you also have to deal with scarcity all the time. So for example, if you have a theater ticketing where you can choose your seat, there is only one seat 5 in the first row. I can't go infinitely concurrent and run the system on millions of servers that are independent on each other because I can only sell this seat once. So I need to actively prevent concurrency way. So,
Well, I was going to ask, so do you take a kind of command query type approach where you request made to the Django request isn't a buy ticket, it's a request to buy a ticket and wait for a response?
Basically, yes. So all ticket buying requests go through a salary queue in Pretix. So it's a task that can be retried and can wait on a queue. And we use PostgreSQL's advisory locks now. To have a very lightweight way of saying, okay, place a lock on this seat, on that quota, on this voucher, on all the kinds of things we lock. So we can, but still this locking limits us in how many tickets we can sell at a time, because in principle, we can only sell one at a time. Of the same type if we need to take care of such conditions. So we're limited at around 1,000 sales per minute or something like that for a given event, because that's just how fast we can get it right now. And the industry startup solution that's not very different to what Ticketmaster and others are doing is like if you go beyond that, you have kind of virtual waiting room where you say, okay, this website is under too much load, please stand in line and we'll let you in soon.
Okay, you do all that. So, I mean, I've seen you give a couple of good talks at DjangoCons. I mean, not just good talks, great talks. One on scaling channels in Edinburgh, which I just thought was the best channels talk I've ever seen. So I do recommend that.
And haven't been that much, to be fair.
But the other one this year was about debugging slow database requests in production, because that's the key, right? It all working fine locally, but then not when you get it out there live.
Yeah, absolutely. Just the other week, we had a slow SQL query that was only debuggable in production. I think we found a PostgreSQL bug, but I'm not too sure yet.
Can I ask a more detailed question, which is, so with your team, how do you, how do you all set up your local machines? Are you using Docker, or how do you, all work on the same thing?
So most of us quite old school with virtual environments and manage.py runs over. So for Pretix, it's really quite simple. For Venueless, because it's a few more components, we have a Docker Compose setup. My local Pretix development is just a virtual env with a package installed.
I mean, the great advantage of the VM or the Docker system is supposedly it's the same in every environment. Do you find there's these cases where running locally doesn't?
Don't forget, like we're not doing exclusively software service, we also have clients and open source users out there running our software on different machines. So having a little bit of chaos in the development arounds as well might even be helpful in ironing out those edge cases.
Oh, that's very true.
We actually like, I develop most of the time, I develop on SQLite and we run on PostgreSQL in production.
I love that. Wow.
It has some challenges, but yeah, it helps to keep some flexibility and surface some bugs.
So then you must be using quite large fixtures to populate your local databases. Is that how you're doing it? How are you working on the same stuff in the team?
No.
No.
Usually, no.
How do you do it?
A colleague now set something up, a Pretix Steamroller plugin where you can like define the system settings in a YAML file and then a small tool applies it through the API. But a lot of it is just run it locally and click through the different cases you need.
Okay. Now you said API. Are you using, and you mentioned Vue earlier, are you using a Vue front end and API back end? Is it all service rendered?
No. It's mostly traditional Django forms and Vues. We use Vue. So we have an extensive API that we use both internally and externally. But we have a few parts of the user interface that are a Vue base. For example, the seating choice element or some other stuff. We have some more complex user interface parts where we use Vue and to build a more interactive component, but the major part is plain how Django was invented.
And are you using Django REST framework for the APIs?
Yes. Yeah.
So you've resisted leaping over to Django Ninja and some of the newer sizzle things?
I am quite resistant against hopping over to the new shiny thing when the old thing still works and I have thousands of lines of code with it. It's one of the challenges now after 10 years. Some things are not that easy to change.
But that's natural, right?
Yeah.
I was talking to Carlton earlier. I'm finally updating I have a book on Django for APIs with Django REST framework. And Django REST framework's in an odd place in that it's feature complete. And yet, so it doesn't, it's not the shiny object, and yet it's used everywhere. And actually, Carlton, that's to you. You helped with the 3.15 rollout, right? Like, are you still officially a maintainer of Django REST framework?
I'm still on the team there, but not really doing very much. I don't, you know, if I'm pinged on an issue, I'll comment, I'll join in. But the thing is, it all works, right? You go, okay, so let's look at going the REST framework folder and we look in the generics. Yep, they're all 100% battle tested. And look in the views, they're all battle tested. Look in the serializers, they're all battle tested. And the bit that people want changes for, they want tweaks for, is in the serializers, because there's a weird behavior. If you've got a null field here combined with that, does it serialize exactly how you would want? Maybe it doesn't. But at this stage in REST framework life, that bug is almost a bug. If it's a bug, it's almost unfixable because people are relying on the current behavior. And so you can't suddenly make it return true rather than null or none in that case, because that would break people's APIs in production. And so those really small kind of just character bugs, they almost can't be addressed now. So what's the solution? I don't know. But REST framework is as reliable as it's been for the last decade. It's just not going anywhere forwards. Like there aren't going to be massive changes to it now, is all. Which is good for your book though, Will, right? Because, you know, you can update it more easily.
Yeah,
for a project like ours as well. Like, why would I want a new major version that breaks a lot of stuff if I don't have a lot of requirements that it doesn't fulfill?
Well, that's the other thing, is what would be the major feature changes that would justify a breaking change in REST framework at this point? And there aren't any.
Well, so I have to ask Raphael, HTMX, right? I'm sure you've had discussions around this. Where do you and your team sit on switching some of the Vue things over to HTMX?
I must admit, I have obviously heard about it and seen it and briefly looked at it. We haven't really tested it in the project. I don't have a strongly formed opinion on it yet.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, it does, and you're in a different situation with a very tested product team. It does seem the advantage is if you're a one or two person team, you can get a lot of the reactive behavior without having to split things up and do front end, back end. It's interesting that there's there was a post, right? There was a post about too much HTMX, I think, that got a bunch of traffic, you know, because it's not, obviously it's not perfect, right? So people are finding the box in which it seems to work best, right? Where solo developer, great, but then there are, of course, these limitations, just like there is with any tool.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is like, I studied physics at university, and physics is a lot about laws, about conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, but there's also conservation of complexity. And if you're trying to build a complex thing, you're going to have the complexity on some layer. And you can, like in different situations, it can be a little bit better of having more of it on a different layer, but it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, and it's kind of like you can shift it around one place or the other. But you said before about Django fitting the way you think and Vue fitting the way you think. That's kind of the way I describe HTMX for me. Is that the reason why I like it is because it fits the way I think and it fits the Django way I think. And so you're exactly right. It's not about reducing complexity. It's just about going along with the way your mind works or not. You know, if you do go along with the way your mind works, it's for some sense easier for a while.
All right. So I want to ask you, sorry, then you can go, Carlton. So managing a team of 21 people and a very popular product, I guess, was that something you expected when you were starting out as a programmer? Were you thinking to be a business owner? No.
No.
But you're still happy. You're still doing it, right? Because sometimes people don't want to do that.
So what I love about it is that I have to deal with entirely new challenges every 6 months. So approximately everything, 6 months, I'm learning something entirely new that I've never done before, and I need to do it now, and I need to understand it. And that is very exciting to me. And so far, it's a lot of fun. Of course, the things that I do day by day have changed a lot. I still spend a lot of time coding, but I also spend a lot of time in meetings internally with clients, with suppliers, with partners and stuff.
Do you have to defend your coding time? Do you have to insist on it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not so hard to find time for fixing bugs and other smallish urgent things because they appear to be urgent and time appears, but it becomes quite hard to find time to work on larger features or larger projects. Luckily, I now have other very capable team members to do that as well. But I still enjoy it, and I believe I'm still useful when doing it.
Okay, on the running a business front, it must be, well, is it deeply rewarding to think that you're giving solid employment to 20 people, 21 people, that like, and you know, that's quite a nice thing to put out into the world now.
I like to think so. It's also a lot of work, and also comes with some challenges, and not without it's a nice result to get from just starting an open source.
So you said a while back, you said that 10 years in, it starts to get harder to make these changes. How do you sort of try to manage that long-term tendency to, you know, because if you don't manage it, you grind to a halt eventually. How do you manage to keep momentum going?
So we try to stay very up to date with a lot of the dependencies that we have, However, that means like we're not going to bother with Django releases that are not on LTS. It's just too much work and not worth it. So we're upgrading 3.2 or 14.2, and we will next be upgrading 5.2. We have the additional challenge that Predix has this plug-in architecture where you can install additional functionality as a plugin. So when we do a major upgrade, like a Django upgrade, we need to do that in around 120 repositories at the same time, which is trivial for some changes like replacing uget text with get text in the imports, and absolutely not trivial with a few other changes like delete view suddenly working differently.
I remember that. I thought, yeah, that's fine. That's fine. No one's going to
get upset about that. But there's a few things that we haven't figured out yet. We, for example, our HTML and CSS is based on Bootstrap 3. And right. I'm not sure we will never upgrade from Bootstrap 3. We will migrate to something custom built but tries to give a backwards compatible journey, because the effort of migrating, I don't know, 5,000 templates to Bootstrap 5 just to do that again for Bootstrap 6, it's not going to work. So with a few things, we'll need to find our own solutions for that.
Okay.
So my last big question is, I want to ask about Stripe and billing, because I think you've been using Stripe from the beginning, at least since 2016, maybe earlier.
It's one of the, I think today, 25 payment providers we integrate with, and it's been the first that we've integrated together with PayPal, I believe. Yeah.
So that's on a very small project of mine. I was just integrating Stripe, and I've done such integrations over the last 7 or 8 years, and Stripe changes all the time with how they do things, and I can't even imagine all the payment providers you've got to deal with. So I guess the question is, how do you manage that, right? Because dealing with money is important to a business, and you don't want to get it wrong. And yet, it seems like so much to juggle.
That brings me to a feature that I would love to have good support for Django REST framework. Because what's really amazing is how Stripe deals with API versioning, I believe. I think they have found the sweet spot for how to version an API when they do breaking changes, because you can set a request header that specifies the API version you are aware of, and it will emulate the behavior of the past API as long as absolutely possible. So Stripe is changing a lot, but actually there have been a few larger changes over the 10 years, but most of the time the changes are don't require a lot of action on our end. We also only use the payments part of Stripe. We don't use the billing or invoices products, because these are all things that we have in our product as well. We have our own invoicing module and so on. I'm not quite sure anymore what the question was, but... so most of the payment providers are not that hard to maintain because they don't change that much, but they need to work well, of course, because people are interested in getting their payment.
Yeah, they seem to care about that. I don't know why.
One more small question. So to store money, integer field, decimal field, positive big integer field, how do you like to do
okay,
it?
Okay, yeah. So we use decimal field consistently.
Okay, and that works.
The arithmetics with decimal field are what you want for money, unless you're on SQLite, but we don't use that in production. SQLite doesn't have a decimal field. It eternally stores it, I believe, as a string, and then there's weird things with it when you try to computation on it. But on PostgreSQL, I believe decimal field is a good fit, except that we will not be able to properly invoice in about 7 of the currencies in the world, because we have money stored decimal field with two decimal places, and there are, I think, seven currencies in the world that have three decimal places, mostly in the Arabic countries. And I'm not sure if we're ever going to be able to properly migrate those fields. We had the problem already, like we had a 10 digits of and two decimal digits we already needed to migrate to larger decimal field, because I don't remember which currency it was, some currency where you have these very large amounts where you like would buy conference tickets for a few million. But in the end, these differences are why I feel or why I'm quite happy with using decimal field, because if you're storing it in, so floating point is wrong. We can get that out of the way. Storing money as floating point numbers is wrong. Storing it as integers brings you to the same problem, because in American projects, it's usually integer of cents. But now you look at the Danish krona, which doesn't have a decimal part of the Japanese yen, or you look at the Jordanian dinar, which is three decimal places. And now either you would need to globally multiply by 1,000, even though that gives you integer representations of things that don't exist in US dollar, or you would need to have different multiplicators for different currencies, which sounds even worse. So the complexity there with internationalization is the same whether you're storing it in decimal fields or integers. There are a few advantages or disadvantages to either one.
Well, I'm about to launch something, so maybe I'll switch to decimal field because I have been using integer. But
so the really bad thing is that a lot of the payment providers, PayPal or Stripe, they specify in their API, please submit the amount in integers of the smallest denomination of the currency.
Yes. Yeah.
And there are some currencies, like I think the Danish krona technically has a decimal point with two places behind it, but it hasn't been used in decades. So, and they don't publish whether they consider it the currency with decimal places or not. So depending on the payment provider, you might need to multiply it with 100 or not. So whatever you do, document very clearly how you want other currencies to be handled.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it's like time zones. It sounds like, oh, money is money, but just like time is not, time zones are not time zones. It's
some,
quite complex.
Like, we store the time of an event as a Django date time, but as time zone aware. But technically, that's wrong. We should be storing local time on a place, because if the time zone legislation changes before because we're dealing with events in the future, like DjangoCon 2025 is going to be in Dublin, Ireland could abolish daylight saving time before it happens, and then all the timestamps in our database would be wrong, and we would need to like manually fix them for all the events that are taking place in Ireland. So far, that hasn't happened, but yeah, there's so much hidden complexity here.
Good. The other day as well, your I18N field came up, which is a solution for storing multiple languages of multiple text translations in a single field, right?
Yeah. So there's quite a few things in Predix where we're doing things maybe a little bit unconventionally and published or packaged. One of them is how we store a translatable string. So if you're hosting a multilingual event, you can also give the event a name in each language and set up email templates in every language. We have a custom field type that allows doing so. That is Django I18N field. There's also Django scopes, which is our way of separating multiple tenants in the same Django project, in the same database. I given a talk about that at DjangoCon Europe 2019 in Copenhagen, I believe, or no, 2020 online. I believe it's on YouTube. And we also, like, we have our custom package. It's called Django Hierarchy, but it's our settings store. We have over 1,000 settings that you can use to configure your ticket store or shop, and we don't want to do a model migration every every time we add one, and it's also like with the plugins and so on. So we have this in-database key value store that has a hierarchical dependency, because you can set things on the tenant level, on the event level, and even on the global level, and it kind of trickles down. You can inherit the settings from an upper layer. So there's a number of small Django packages that we maintain because, yeah, it's useful for us and maybe for someone else as well.
But like you'd said that you did it in an unconventional way, but these are kind of battle-tested ways. They've grown out of your actual needs, right? And so, you know, you might, the IAT NEM field, you might not want to store the repeated blobs in the same field, but well, actually that works for you and it's simpler for fetching, it's simpler for various others.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're getting a little bit close on time. Is there anything, you know, we haven't asked you or that you wanted to bring attention to?
No, I don't think so. We'll prepare for the question.
Oh, well, that's our fault. I mean, normally we would ask something around what would you change in Django, but I think Carlton led off with that early on. So, you know, the magic wand, right? What would you change? Is there anything else that comes to mind in core Django that you'd like to just make so?
So for REST framework, as mentioned, API versioning, that is really helpful for on both ends. In core Django, yeah, I think what we talked about before, I think we need built-in batteries for two-factor authentication.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be something you add extra. I'm not so sure about single sign-on, OpenID Connect, someone's own, because that's very complex and that's very that's also changing landscape. But I think we really need like if I install Django and set up a Django admin, two-factor authentication should be the default. Should be fully integrated, yeah.
And there's no reason why Django couldn't ship some kind of adapter layer. Like, you know, like Django could define the interface that if you implement that, then you could add your auth flow for, I don't know, login by whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I feel like we could ask you questions for another couple of hours, but it's a really impressive thing that you've built. I would say, you know, open source project, organizer, team of 21, and maybe most impressive is finding the time to still code yourself. I think maybe that's part of why you seem to enjoy it, right? Sometimes people have monetary success, but if they get moved away from the engineering or core work that they really enjoy, I've seen people who don't really enjoy the success of their companies when they're in meetings all day long. And
yeah, it's understandable. Yeah, so far it's for me.
Great. Well, we'll have links to everything, especially your talks, which your talks are fantastic on all these topics we've mentioned. And hopefully I'll get to see you in DjangoCon Europe next year. Are you planning to attend in Dublin?
I'm not so sure yet. But I hope
okay.
So. The year after, definitely.
Okay. Well, fingers crossed for those.
Fingers crossed. So we are at djangochat.com and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.